It's nice to be here and also to meet some old friends. I also want to thank David Zebedee, who you know as John Hay, for the opportunity to come out here. You all know what he's doing with this school, and I think a wonderful job, and I think a job that needs to be done. And I have nothing but words of the highest praise. All right, G-O-D. Where is that? Don't give me any answers, let me tell you. There's nothing but some scratches, it's on the blackboard. But these scratches have a pointing function. They are symbolic. They are symbols. And they point to something which is beyond us. They point to a different concept for every person that's in this room. And that is thanks to the freedom, which, whatever it is, that this is a symbol, the concept of, has ordained that we shall have. I doubt that in this room there are two identical concepts of God. Now, don't be shocked when I say to you that I don't have a concept of God. Because to me, God is so far beyond any concept that I may derive in my puny brain that it is an unreal reality. Now, that's a paradoxical statement of the contradiction in terms, as our philosophical friends will say, and so forth. But it has a meaning. God is so far beyond the finite concept of him, or it, if you prefer, that it's ineffable. And that's a nice, high-powered philosophic word, meaning that it's something that you can feel but you can't describe. Now, I have suggested that this would be an excellent book to read as an auxiliary. Primarily, this is a layman's guide to Protestant theology. Now, what is theology? Theology is a philosophical discussion of your religion. If it's a philosophical discussion of somebody else's religion, it's psychology. Because our religion is an extremely personal thing to each and every one of us. And if we could, as your religions, reach the point where we could regard this, or rather we could regard this phenomenon in the minds of other people with the same respect and the dignity which we give it to ourselves, then we would be on the way to becoming true Urantians. In a discussion of this kind, there are so many starting places, they're almost legion. But in the context of what we're trying to do here today, is to compare some of the historical concepts of God in the world religions, more particularly Christianity, as alongside the concept of God as presented in the Urantia book. Actually, the reason and the purpose for this is that we have here a group of people who are apparently very much interested in the Urantia book, or you wouldn't be here. To be interested in it, in the Urantia book, implies that you have stuck your neck into something that eventually is going to force you, perhaps against your will, and to want to disseminate these teachings and to bring other, that is to bring this information to other people. Now, no, I do not say to convert other people. You present the information and they convert themselves, as you did. Because anyone that moves and does anything with your engine work has already made some decisions of their own. Now, this is not easy. Vern Grimsley takes a quote out of the book, and he says, the easiest way for a tadpole to become a frog is to live loyally each moment as a tadpole. You've all seen that. He also adds that in order to do this, you have to work your tail off. So that there is lots of work involved. Now, it it's interesting to note, and let's, for the first little while here, let's assume that God, in the final analysis, is indefinable. Now, the human mind is so constructed that we can't talk about God unless we've got some kind of a concept for it, because it's very difficult for us to understand things that don't have definitions. And if you have a definition, then you are attempting to form a concept of a something. The human concept of God has had a long period of evolution, which goes back way back before prehistory, and it's tied in with the innate religious consciousness or subconsciousness of man. Going through, well, for instance, a number of years back, Harry Emerson Fosdick wrote a very interesting book called The Key to Understanding the Bible, in which he traced out the evolution of the God concept in both the Hebrew and the Christian religion. And he points out that the original God concept was about as primitive as the people themselves were, and that the God of Mount Sinai, the God of the thunder and the lightning and so forth, maybe you've seen this Jewish or Hebrew cartoon. It shows an old man with a long white beard standing like this, and he's got a couple of stones in his arm. He's up on the top of a mountain, looks like some kind of a peak, and he's looking up, and there's a great swirling lightning-laced cloud that just right over his head. He likes this, and he's saying, "Well, they only ask what order of priority." That God was a God of thunder and lightnings and revenge, and he did contain one thing, which is a characteristic thing that comes to us down through the Old Testament, and that is the concept of justice. We owe the Hebrews and the Hebrew Bible and its religion a great deal for the origin and the preservation of concepts of justice as related to God. Now, he could roar and thunder on the top of the mountains, and he could cause cities to be burnt and floods to occur and so forth, in showing people that justice must be done. But that concept is quite in kin, quite in line with the actual level of intellectual attainment or experiential attainment of the people. We move along very rapidly in the Bible, and we find in the second Isaiah, one of the most beautiful portions of the Hebrew Bible, an expanded concept of God, which is the precursor of the concept which Jesus so beautifully portrayed in his life experience on this planet as a God of love. But this is quite an evolution, and it goes through a good many stages before it has evolved from a concept of a God of love, from that of a concept of might and vengeance, and the idea that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And then, of course, the concept of God which Jesus presented is one that is presented in its entirety and its best representation in the Urantia book. Although there are many Christian writings that have gotten the idea, able to get the reference, able to get the taste of the God of love, which the second Isaiah so aptly suggests, and which Jesus so very effectively demonstrated in his life on this planet. So, remember, I'm not erasing God. I'm just erasing the symbol, which is the concept, that which represents the concept of God. Why do we say concept? And I have already used that word a good many times, and I will use it much more during the balance of the afternoon. Why do we say concept? Because as we said at the beginning, we cannot hold the idea, the concept of what God is really like. Why? Because we are finite beings. We have a limited conceptual capacity. It is limited by the periphery of our own human mind. To illustrate, you can't teach a little child calculus because he has not had enough experience in life yet. To be able to conceive, and when I say conceive, I mean to form a concept of what calculus, for instance, is all about, or even trigonometry or algebra. But as it grows, its concept capacity is continually expanding. And I would submit to you that one of the beautiful promises which is inherent in the Urantia book is that when our conceptual capacity of God grows to the point of where we can stand in front of Him and recognize Him, then we will figuratively be able to shake hands. But remember that all this time in this 200 billion years approximately that it's going to take for us to get that far, that He has already recognized us long since. Recognized us from the time that we actually made our first independent moral decision. And He gave us at that time a part of Himself to become the eternal promise that we will stand in front of Him one day and not only be recognized, but recognize Him. So, is there a necessity for a God concept? I think Paul Tillich expresses it very well when he says that God is a matter of concern for all of us. And he uses the fact that we are finite beings. And when we become aware, when we become self-conscious of the fact that we are finite beings, there is something in us which Tillich calls the essential nature of our being, which in another place can be called a thought adjuster or a mystery monitor or an indwelling fragment of God, that makes us conscious of the fact that as finite beings, we are separated or being separated from infinity. And that this sets up an estrangement or its attention here. And this attention can cause serious psychological problems in some people. So why a concept of God? We become aware of something beyond the level of the finite, and this, according to Tillich, will motivate us to seek for the necessity for the personalization or the development of an object which represents to us as individuals our highest values that we can conceive at a finite level.
Now, do you think that there is as much a need for a concept of God as there is a need for knowing God, or do you think the two are the same?
I think you have to have a concept because knowing implies knowing something. And this something is the content of which is the highest values that we are able to conceive in the finite level. Because what is God? Oh, essentially, he's starting out from scratch. He is the personalization for all of us of the highest values existing in the universe. And then we go on from there towards trying to know what we can know about God. So,
I meant the difference between knowing about God and knowing God.
Well,
two different.
We care all about God. But I doubt very much at this stage of the game that we can know God.
As Jesus is about God, Christ Michael is about.
Mm-hmm.
Such as Christ Michael is about God.
Christ Michael portrayed God to a finite mind, and he portrayed God at a level that finite mind could comprehend.
So we're writing on about God rather than we're writing on actually knowing God.
We are writing about God, but each one of us is going to grasp some concept, or is going to grasp the concept as our own personal concept of God. You see, we've really gotten to the core of a big problem here, philosophically speaking and theologically speaking. The first thing is, what is God? And the second thing, can I know God? Well, in our concept-forming ability, we form concepts as to what God is for us. Your entry book comes along and expands that concept. That is one of the many purposes of the Urantia book, is to expand that concept. To expand what in one place it says you can't pour a quart into a pint container. But it is saying that this pint container can be constantly enlarged so that someday it's going to be able to hold a quart. And then we'll start looking and attempting to pour a half gallon into it.
I feel like that when the book talks about knowing God, it's like a child, a little, like you were talking before about a child, can know his father, but not understand his father, or what he does in life, or anything.
That's well put, much better, much more simply than what I did, but that's correct.
So we can know God in that sense, but we can't understand him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, as Jesus, and the perversion happened about Jesus, the teachings about Jesus rather than the teachings of Jesus, So are we susceptible, in a sense, to the teachings about the Father, in a way, since we cannot understand them, as you say.
Well, the teachings of Jesus
teachings of the Father, right.
Yeah.
But we can much more solidly know Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, than maybe what we're trying to grasp even now.
Look for God in the teachings of Jesus. Now, something is beginning to shape up here, and that is this, that we are perhaps inclined, or we may wish to become overly definitive in our terms about knowing of God and knowing about God, or knowing God and knowing about God. Time and time again, throughout these papers, you are told that we have to dilute this statement, we have to modify these statements in order to make it presentable to the mortal mind, to the finite human mind. The authors of the paper repeat this statement through over time and time again. Now,
what's ineffable mean again?
Yeah.
Indescribable.
We felt was.
It's unutterable. For instance, William James, in his Varieties of Religious Experience, and you know that he draws four conclusions, two of which are very basic, about the religious experience itself. And he points out that the first conclusion which he draws about the religious experience itself is that it is one, ineffable. That means that it's an experience that the human being has, that to him, it cannot be put in human terms. And yet, the only way that he or she can describe that experience to a very close friend is to use it his own human terms. Now, this is a problem that all through the ages has bothered the mystics. Now, the mystics, supposedly, had religious experiences. The medieval church recognized these experiences, and then the greatest problem that the medieval church had was that they didn't know how to deal with the mystic. So they generally waited from 50 to 100 years after his death, and then they excommunicated him. And this thing happened to Meister Eckhart. He was excommunicated something like 100 years after he died. But Meister Eckhart was sufficiently kept in his mystical experience that he said, beyond God is the Godhead, which is unknowable, unexperienceable by man. And that's as close as he could come. Now the problem the mystic has, and this is how a lot of cults and so forth get started, you cannot describe any experience that you have except in terms of your own culturization. If you're a chemist, you tend to think and talk in terms of your training. If you're a biologist or if you are a literature major, you're going to use different terms. This is a problem with mysticism, that is, the basic experience is undescribable. But somehow or other, they get around to describing it, and when they do, they must describe it in their own personal terms. And this brings it down to earth, and this takes a lot of the mystery out of it, yeah.
Is this very much like when Jesus said to Peter, after he asked the question, who am I? And a couple of the apostles said, some say thou art Jeremiah. And another apostle said, some would say thou art Ezekiel, prophesied people for to come. And Peter said, he says, Jesus was adamant, says, who do you say I am? And Peter says, I see that you are the Son of God. And that was a mystical experience. And Peter, you can't really be defined in logical, rational form.
From a revelational point of view, that was for Peter and for Peter alone.
He said, blessed art thou for the keys of the kingdom will give it to you.
For Peter and for Peter alone, that was a mystical experience.
And that is like kind of the only way, it's like a little bit beyond rationalism. Yeah.
And that's the way that Peter expressed it. But the very expression, that is the roots of that very expression, was already present in Peter's subconscious mind. Because his enculturization in the Jewish faith had already given him the idea of the Messiah and of the Son of God and the Son of Man. So it was already there in his subconscious mind. And he was merely expressing it in terms of his own enculturization. So our task for us is to get a concept of God that is not ineffable, and it is accessible or available, useful is a better word, concept, useful to finite beings. And that's what we're all about here today. Because we're all concerned in a practical, pragmatic approach to what we have to do. So we want to be able to get some concepts so that we can talk together. Now the opening statement of the Urantia book says that the Universal Father is the God of all creation, a creator, an upholder, and controller of all things and beings. That's the very first statement in the Urantia book. 2,097 pages later, the last statement says, when all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. So, I want you to notice one thing. Whenever we think of the word Father, it has a very personal and emotional connotation for us. It is in most instances, a respected being, a being that has had a very livable part in our existence, our own personal lives, and it means something to us. However, please note that the statement that does not say the Father at the beginning of the book. It says the Universal Father. And I want to talk a little bit this afternoon about what the Universal Father means. Any suggestions about what the Universal Father means? What does universal mean?
Everywhere.
Everything.
Everything.
Everything. What is another name that's found in the Urantia book for the all of everything, if you want to use the term?
I am.
Aha! Somebody's been reading the book. Our friends, all throughout the book, have used human terms wherever they could. But do you remember what Jesus said to the Pharisee when they asked him about Abraham? He said, "Before Abraham was, I am." What does that tell you? That concept is timeless. Holy cow, we have to live in a time, a space continuum, and we've already jumped out of it. See? This is some of the marvel of the Urantia book. It's trying to get us out of ourselves. Now, just a little aside here for a moment. Let's think of that as a picture frame. Let's call that a reference framework. Now, a reference framework or a picture frame has got a border on it. And if you put a picture in there, you always put the picture inside the border, don't you? So when the Urantia book writers are talking about personal reference frameworks, what they are talking about is that they are trying to construct for us personal reference frameworks in which they can include all the ideas and the concepts that they are trying to get across to us in such a way that they can fit them into this reference framework. When I look at the job they get, or I look at the problem that they have, here is something with boundaries on it, which automatically makes it finite. And yet they want to give us a concept called the I Am, and they know that we've got to use a reference framework. See? So they say, we've got to talk to you, we've got to use distortions of language, we've got to squeeze word, we've got to use distortions of meanings. And it challenges you to use your imagination right to the utmost. And this we have to do, you see? So that when we talk about the I Am, we've got to try to put a structure on that reference framework. Now let's start out, for instance, with the reference framework. Let's say, boy, that's the I Am. Now this isn't solely for fun, because philosophy today is out on the perimeter of the areas conceptually wise that we are talking about right now. And those of you who have been into the meat and the potatoes of Paul Tillich, who in my opinion is on the borderline or is in the borderline, but it's actually stretched beyond it, between orthodoxy and liberalism, that his concept of the ground to being is, by its nature, although not actually definitively so, the same as the I Am. So when we talk about the Universal Father, we have to think about the Universal Father as the father of everything. And what does that mean? That means that somehow or other we've got to conceive that the Universal Father is also the father of this. Every bit of our material energy in this world has proceeded at some time or other from the I Am. So what do our friends tell us? They say that we've got to make a concession to the human mind. So what do? They say, in order to understand the I Am, we're going to postulate a hypothetical moment. Now a moment is static, but infinity is indefinable. So we've got a static moment in something that we can't define. That's the world's greatest paradox. It just ain't so. But they say, we've got to do this in order for the human mind to understand how the I Am becomes what it is. So they say that a way back, and here is another contradiction of terms, a way back in past eternity, and that's a contradiction in terms, because eternity to us is supposed to represent past, present, and future all coexisting. But they say a way back in eternity, something happened. All they say is that the I Am exists. The I am has the maximum character of isness. And that's all they say. They don't say it's male or female. They don't say it's energy or matter. They also use some other terms. They say it is neither actual nor potential. It is neither pre-potential. It is not personal. It's not pre-personal. All we can say is that the I am is. So if you can look out and project your reference framework out there and say, there is a whole mess of isness, but it isn't even isness, really. It's just out there. If we're getting a little vague, we hadn't better, you know, we don't want to go much farther than this.
Well, what about it being in there, too? Is there that side of it as well?
In here, it's in you.
It's right, as opposed to, you know, it's out there and then it's in there. I mean, there's a whole lot more to it than what's just out there.
It is there.
Oh, yes, yeah. We are coming to that. What I'm trying to do is to give you some kind of a sequential development that you can keep in your mind and carry with you as a godness concept, which is beyond anything that you've ever had before. And so we're going a little bit beyond the personal. So, the I am has one thing. Volition. And that volition can't be there unless there is something to decide. Now, if we think back to that hypothetical moment in eternity, in which there is nothing but its existence, then in order to have volition, there must be mind. And what that mind says, this mind makes a primary separation. And this is called the whole thing, is the infinite, according to your book. That's the I am. It's the same thing. The infinite. Now what happens is, way back in this hypothetical moment of past eternity, and again, that's this conversation, something happens. As a result of volition, the infinite one separates, and that leaves the infinite two. Right off the bat, what does this suggest when we say infinite one?
Father, universal, basic.
Personal, who said personal, you're right. Something personal, see? All right, if we have extracted all of the personal elements out of infinity, and there's anything left, then the feet must be all of the impersonal elements. And this whole thing is still wrapped up in infinity. It's possible, then, for these things to go through another metamorphosis. And we have relationships. And the first and the primal relationship is the I am as Father of the Eternal Son. This is the primary personal relationship. The next relationship is the I am as the author of paradise. Now, if you remember your description of paradise, it is the primary impersonal pattern for the whole universe, or for everything. What's happened? We've got the same bifurcation here between personal and impersonal. The next thing that happens is that the Father and the Son establish a relationship. So this is, I am as the Father and Son in relationship. The repercussion of that is the infinite spirit. Now, we have a father relationship here. The I am is also the father and the son relationship. And we have the I am as the source of all of the energies of the universe, all encapsulated at this hypothetical moment in past eternity in the Isle of Paradise. So, but we've got a few things left here. We started out with three things, and there is a possibility of several more relationships. So we find out that things have to stay in balance. Well, these are actualities. We'll get to the balance system. But these are actualities. Now, there is still a tremendous amount of potential left so that we have the I am as the source of the deity absolute. We have the I Am as the source, the unqualified absolute, and we have the I Am as the I Am, and this is what unifies it all together in the universal absolute. And the I Am as the I Am. These are relationships. This is only one step, because these all eternalize, but these eternalize is from the Father to the Son, creating the Isle of Paradise for the infinite spirit, and the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute, and the universal absolute. Now what are these? These are the seven absolutes of infinity. The first four are the existential absolutes of both person and impersonal reality, personal and impersonal reality, and these last three are the eternal promise of the future, the promise of a never-ending future, because these contain all of the potentials for a future reality, both personal and impersonal, personal in the deity absolute, impersonal, the world, the universe, the force charge of space, everything involved in here, unified by the universal absolute. And when someone says, well, how does universal absolute work? The universal absolute is concerned with the well-being of the whole thing. And how would that affect us? All right, let's take a very simple physical explanation. And there is one. Very simple physical explanation is, it is a fact that most metals, most materials, contract, they become smaller in size, when the temperature surrounding them becomes less and they become colder. This is true on this planet of ours, but there's one very simple, very necessary product that doesn't. And what is this product? This product's water. Water at 4 degrees begins to expand. And it includes a little space so that its density becomes less. Now, what's the practical application of that as far as you and I and this whole world are concerned? It forms ice, and ice floats. And if ice didn't float, if ice had started to sink, all the oceans of the world, the bottoms, which are the most fertile source for life, would be all enclosed in ice, and there would be no life. And every stream and every lake would have a load of ice on the bottom, and life as we know it would not be possible. And I suggest that there is a very crude way to suggest how the universal absolute would balance out any tensions that exist between personal beings and impersonal things. This sequential self-segmentation and these relationships that we have been talking about here are the origin and the genesis of reality as presented in the Urantia book. On page 1157 or something like, somewhere around in there, in the Urantia book, there is one of the few statements that is in total italics. And this statement says, remember, that your personal concept of the Father, and we can call this the Loving Father, your personal concept of God as a Father must ever be less than your philosophic concept of the I Am. And I think we have shown you, or we have tried very hard this afternoon so far, to show you the difference between the two.